Welcome to Bike for Life Stories. Stories from a lifetime of cycling all over the world that will amuse, teach, inspire, and make you think. Written and narrated by Roy M. Wallach. Today's featured story is Go to Hawaii and Climb Your Brains Out. How to Survive the World's Tallest Sea-to-Summit Ascent. I was a little scared. 14 or 15,000 feet of climbing is a lot in one day. So I sought spiritual guidance from Pastor Ka'apu, the white-haired holy man leading a traditional Hawaiian prayer at my Big Island hotel. Bring a ho'okipu, a small gift of significance, to acknowledge that the spirit of the sacred mountain allowed you to transcend, he said, clasping my shoulder. And good luck. At sunrise the next day, 6:54 a.m., I dipped my front tire in the Pacific Ocean and grabbed a small seashell. The ho'okipu. My plan. Deposit it later that day at the top of the sacred mountain, Mauna Kea, Hawaii's tallest mountain and the steepest, highest, and shortest sea-to-summit hill climb in the world, 13,796 feet in about 46 miles. The payoff at the top promised to be spectacular. Winter snowdrifts 30 feet high, Mauna Kea means white mountain in Hawaiian, and the world's clearest views of the stars, which is why 13 national observatories from 11 nations are located up there. Their white and metallic domes making it look like a surreal neighborhood of giant igloos. The peak's isolation in the middle of the vast Pacific Ocean and lack of light pollution not only make it an astronomer's dream, but sacred ground to native Hawaiians, to tourists hunting for a Kodak moment sunset, and to spiritual groups seeking nexus points of the universe. In 1994, I'd driven up to the top of Mauna Kea with my wife. I vowed to climb it someday by bike. That day arrived in February 2011 with a business trip to the Big Island to interview some pro triathletes training on the nearby Hawaii Ironman race course. Although the Mauna Kea climb has long stretches exceeding a 17% grade, has 40% less oxygen in the air at the top than at the beginning, several miles of gravel dirt road near the top, and no access to food or water after the visitor center at 9,200 feet, I wasn't worried. Several times over the years, I'd biked Maui's well-known 36-mile, 10,000-foot climb up Mount Haleakala, the world's steepest continuous all-paved sea-to-summit road, and done it in about 5 hours. Although not particularly fast, the record is half that, I naturally assumed that it'd be a simple matter of knocking off 4,000 more feet of elevation in another 2 or 2.5 hours, max. Having read on the internet of a man who did Mauna Kea in 6 hours, I told my crew and a photographer, I'll be done in about 8 hours, by 3 p.m. That would give us plenty of time to make it back downhill to catch my flight home at 10:30 that night. Well, that was a fool's math. I didn't realize that while the shortest climb up Mauna Kea is 46 miles from the east coast city of Hilo, it's 13 miles longer, with an extra 1,000 feet of climbing and descending on a route from my hotel on the Kahala coast on the Big Island's west side. That extra distance would take its toll. In the morning, I left the coast after 10 miles and began the climb. The lush tropical scenery faded into grassland and then rocky scrubland by the time I reached the Saddle Road, the sole cross-island route between Mauna Kea and its smaller southern sister, Mauna Loa, an active volcano just 120 feet shorter. I stood on the pedals because the saddle is nasty steep for 90 minutes before it flattens in the island's wind-blasted midsection, which slows you to a crawl as it travels through U.S. military weapons training grounds, which are complete with the sounds of distant explosions and screaming jet engines. I reached the turnoff to Summit Road, the final road to the top, about 12:30 p.m., more than 5 hours after I started. I'd already ridden 46 miles and climbed 7,500 feet, and I was at least 90 minutes behind schedule. I thought I could make up time on the final push to the top, but that proved delusional because it was about to get a lot worse. Reaching the observatories 14 miles up Summit Road required another 7,500 feet of climbing. I didn't fully appreciate the task until mile 4, when the grade went to 17%. At 17%, you push one pedal at a time as if it bears the weight of the world. At 17%, you can barely ride faster than you can walk. As the elevation went to 7,000 and then 8,000 feet, I had to walk at least half the time. When I reached the visitor center at just over 9,000 feet, it was 2 p.m. Waiting there was my crew, a group from my trip sponsor, Trek Bicycle. I couldn't have done this without them. Trek had loaned me my bike, and the crew had brought me something to eat and drink a few hours earlier. Unfortunately, they also brought me bad news. The road ahead was even worse, including miles and miles of gravel and dirt, and they had to leave me behind because of a meeting. They wouldn't be able to ferry me down the mountain to the hotel after I reached the top. That meant I'd be in serious risk of missing my flight. They suggested I bail. I shook my head. I'd done way too much work to turn back now. I'd just hitch a ride home at the top because I was going to finish this thing. It was just another 8 miles. Another 8 miles with 4,592 feet of climbing, starting at about 9,000 feet of elevation. The first 4.6 miles of the final stretch was unpaved to discourage tourists and bicyclists, joked a ranger at the visitor center. It's only paved after that to stop dust that could clog the telescopes. He was right. The dirt road was discouraging, especially with really skinny tires. Mostly walking, occasionally riding in solid spots, I finished the first mile in 23 minutes. At home, with sea-level oxygen on a solid surface, I can happily walk a mile in 15 minutes. But in the dirt, with 20 to 40% less oxygen in the air, a mile seemed to take forever. My lungs began audibly heaving for breath. Step by agonizing step, I slowed into 30 and 40 minute miles. As I was occasionally passed in a cloud of dust by vans ferrying tourists to the top to see the famous Mauna Kea sunset, my relentless optimism began to break down. I am an idiot, I began to mutter at around 12,000 feet. It was now late afternoon. The sun drooped and the temperatures fell. I could see the paved switchbacks to the top just ahead, but they seemed to grow no closer. I grew despondent. I put on my vest against the looming chill and wallowed in utter dejection and self-damnation. I was going to miss the sunset, miss a ride home, and miss my 10:30 flight. Finally, when I had 3 miles to go, the road turned to blacktop, but it was too steep to ride. At 5:42 p.m., walking, I reached the road sign marking 13,000 feet of elevation and hung my head in abject hopelessness. The remaining 1.5 miles and 796 feet of elevation seemed impossible. Finally, as the sun started to flirt with the horizon, the grade moderated. With a desperate burst of energy, I pedaled the last couple of switchbacks through mile 8 at 6:18 p.m. and arrived at a surreal neighborhood of round white metallic observatory domes, the horizontal rays of a dying sun glinting off them like blinding welding torch flames. Parked on the ledge were a half dozen red tourist vans. Almost 12 hours after I'd started, I'd made it just in time to see the sunset. Lightheaded, dehydrated, I dismounted and began to stumble over to the viewpoint. That's when I noticed a handful of young Japanese adults in bright orange parkas running at me with a weird, wild-eyed hysteria. They were screaming something over and over. It took a couple seconds to understand it through their accents, but they were saying, "Hero! Hero! You a hero!" Yes, after walking most of the last 11 of the slowest, most challenging miles of my life, I'd become their hero. From their vans, they'd all seen me trudging along the dirt road. A dozen of them now swarmed around me, shaking my hand and posing for pictures with their wasted 55-year-old American hero and his borrowed bicycle. Feeling almost drunk, giddy from the lack of oxygen and food, I started laughing uncontrollably. As my reward for climbing 15,000 feet from sunrise to sunset, it seemed like I'd just won some sort of prize on a kooky Japanese reality TV show. How could I ask for a better ending than this? Actually, it does get better. Quickly, I started to freeze. After being turned down for a hitchhike by all the tour bus drivers, "Legally, no can do, man," they said. I spotted a white four-door Ford truck and knocked on the window. It was the friendly Australian couple, Ruth and Andre Fletcher of Melbourne, who'd stopped halfway through the dirt road and given me some desperately needed water. I hopped in the back seat. We finished watching the sunset fade from orange to crimson to black, and for the next 2 hours, the Fletchers drove me back to my hotel on the Kohala coast. I made it to my flight with 5 minutes to spare. When I was flying back to LA that night, I realized two things. There weren't any 30-foot snowdrifts up there. It had been a warm February. And I'd forgotten to lead my ho'okipu, the seashell from the beach at the top of Mauna Kea, as Pastor Ka'apu had advise me. So the first chance I get to visit the Big Island again, I vowed to go back up there with seashell in hand and do it right. Only next time, I'll probably do it by car.